Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and joining me now is Dr. Mark Elbrock, who is an ecologist, author, scientist, and storyteller, and works in wildcat science and conservation. Dr. Elbrock, thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, I want to get started talking about you first so we can understand a little bit more about your background. What led you into this line of work?
I was born fascinated with animals, quite literally, and that's all my family tells me. I have cousins who joke that it was always terrible to be locked in the back seat of the vehicle for a long drive with me because they received some lecture on red foxes or something else. Learned that there were people like Jane Goodall who made a career of it and like lived with animals. So that was sort of what I had in my head growing up, was that that would be a great job for me. You know, getting lots of experience and learning about wildlife tracking was sort of a big chunk of my time, was learning to identify footprints and follow trails and find animals. And it ended up that I was good at it. And so I started being sort of requests for me to help people find and catch animals, and got me closer and closer to the biologists in the field, and eventually went to school myself, meaning graduate school, and had the opportunity to kind of create my own questions rather than always working to answer someone else's.
I love the idea of that, creating your own questions, because the more and more you know about a field, it seems when you're a scientist, the more questions that you actually do have, because you're always in this world of discovery. So I think that's such a great way to put that. And so when you bring yourself into this world of biology and you become this ecologist, you leaned toward wild cats. What was it about that specific species that was interesting to you?
That's a great question. A little bit the wrong question. and the reason I say that is because a lot of folks who get into wildlife work, you tend to take the jobs that are offered and the opportunities that are offered. And, you know, I was particularly obsessed with fishers and black bears for many, many years, and thought that I would love to have a career path working with those species, you know, learning about them. But alas, the opportunity came up to work with mountain lions instead, which is, I would not describe as a terrible fate, but, you know, that was the opportunity that came before me. I was looking at the time when I was really thinking about going back to school, because I wanted to, you know, to learn that side of things, how to gather data in a non-biased way, how to ask your questions without bias, how to analyze data so you could really see if you could find answers to some of the things that you pose. And I was looking for a project that would allow me to be in the field utilizing my sort of unique set of skills, which was very much sort of field skills of finding animals, following animals, interpreting signs. And so I was particularly interested in mountain lions because they kill animals. And those kill sites fascinated me. And sort of like I wanted to create a graduate program where I could go and visit the places where mountain lions had killed prey over and over and over again to see all the cool things I could learn. And so that's how I got into it. And now I think, you know, more to your point, why have I stuck with them? Because I could have leapfrogged to the next species like everybody else does. But I've been working with mountain lions for, you know, gosh, my first mountain lion project was in 2000, January 2000. And they're beautiful. They're athletic. They're, you know, easy to fall in love with as a species. They're amazing. And then the two things that I would emphasize is, one, that people have very strong feelings about them. They either love them or they hate them. And both of those are really useful to kind of harness as a scientist, because it means people are passionate about it and they're interested. And so they're interested in supporting you and the work you're doing because they want the answers too. So that's one big point. And then the second is that it's super challenging. The physicalness of like climbing mountains and looking for cats and trying to catch them, and the hiking to get to the kill sites. I mean, they wander these huge rugged landscapes often, or at least that's where I've mostly worked. I just love that too, and like that it was socially hard. You're dealing with people who are really against what you're up to. If you're talking about conservation, you're dealing with state agencies who are, gosh, just so many of them are stuck in an ancient past when they thought that the people really didn't want to share a landscape with these animals. And so you're always like, there's so many challenges, whether it's physical, mental, emotional, and that honestly feeds me. I like challenges, and it's kept me going.
So when you're talking about landscapes and on the map where you find mountain lions, can you describe for us where you're talking and what terrains you have passed through?
Yeah, so most of my life in terms of working on this species has been in what I would describe as wilder landscapes, far from people. I've spent time in parts of Patagonia in Chile. I have worked in, the rugged Gros-Ventre lower Yellowstone ecosystem which is, almost entirely public lands, just in the places where there were less people and more animals. And that kind of changed, honestly, quite recently when I moved to Washington, which is now almost 10 years ago. And here, the cats are in people's backyards all the time. So now I'm more in a not quite suburban, but leaning more towards suburban landscape where it's like an interface between wild places and human landscapes, and the cats are living, sometimes successfully, sometimes running into issues amongst the people that they share land with.
Right, and I often think about it as actually we're in their backyard. So we're kind of setting up camp where they would normally be. And so it is this integration with this wildlife. I'm curious as to how far-reaching a mountain lion can be across the world. Where do you find them?
They have the largest range of any terrestrial, meaning living on land, mammal in the Americas. So they stretch from about halfway up Canada all the way down to the southern tip of South America. And historically, they went from the Atlantic coast to the Pacific coast, in both continents. And so, yeah, I mean, a huge range. In terms of other large carnivores that have really big distributions, you have wolf, gray wolf, which is circumpolar. You find them in, Norway and Sweden and Russia, as well as in North America. And then leopard is another big, wide-ranging one, all of Africa, but across the Middle East, even into India, and then subspecies of leopard that go all the way into Russia as well. So, these are a few of the species that are super wide-ranging.
So with mountain lions, what is it about their physicality or their physiology, those attributes that lend themselves to be in so many different places across the planet?
That's a great question. It's one of the great questions that we always are asking ourselves is like, why are some cats more successful than others? Why some carnivores are more successful than others? So I will lean into some speculation here, but it's fascinating to kind of look across species. They are highly effective, efficient hunters. And they have to be because they share most of their range with other carnivores that are larger, stronger, or more competitively, suited than they are. And so they lose about a third, if not more, of the food that they kill to other carnivores. And so I think it's that weird place of being sort of a subordinate but yet highly efficient large carnivore that creates this sort of flexibility in their lifestyle that, they're used to hardship in different ways, and they've become less confrontational than many species. So they're not super aggressive, and they generally relinquish kills. They're not going to try to defend it. They just say, fine, I'll go hunting elsewhere, and here you can have what I've killed. And that non-confrontation has allowed them again to kind of survive where others might not, because they would have been more confrontational. And that leads to, just think of humans. When there's war, people die. And so if you can be a peaceful nation and not engage in wars, your people will have a better chance of thriving. So, that's some of the things I think about with this species.
And they're so stealth. It's interesting because we have these conversations here where people will say, oh, I don't think I've ever been in the midst of a mountain lion. I've never seen one. And, you know, most people say, oh, they've seen you. You have definitely been watched by a mountain lion if you've gone hiking here in our neck of the woods. What are the ways in which they're very stealth, and where are you most often going to find them? Because I've heard most often it's look up.
You're totally right. I hear that all the time too, that, you know, if you may have never seen one, but they've seen you kind of mentality. And, you know, gosh, there's probably some truth to it. They are amazingly confident about their camouflage. They do blend in remarkably well, even though they're one color and they don't have spots and stripes that would help them blend. But they, yes, they're quiet. They're so quiet, and they move slowly, you know, so that doesn't attract the eye as well. And they're patient. They have incredible patience. They can sit and look and watch for long periods of time. And people who've experienced them in the woods, this often puts them off because they get nervous when a cat is looking at them for any length of time. But that's just cat behavior, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can learn that from watching even domestic cats. They like to watch. They like to consider things. They consider their moves. I think this is part of the reason why they're successful or have survived, is that they, when they are confronted with something new, they sit down, they watch it, and they think about it. And then they make a decision whether to engage or whether to explore more. They are, of course, curious, like any smart, large animal. And that helps as well. It kind of helps them solve problems. But yeah, very quiet, like to be watching. They don't make a lot of noise in comparison to other species. Their hunting strategy is one that they forage alone. And that means that, you know, packs of mountain lions don't get together and say, let's go kill an elk. They hunt alone. And so they have to be stealthy to get close enough to make that really short, quick run to pounce on the back or the throat of whatever they're hunting. And, you know, without getting close, they have no chance because their entire physiology is about short sprints and not long distance. And they can't maintain a run for very long. So they have to either catch it or give up.
And like you said, that's very leopard or cheetah-like, that these cats expend this energy very quickly. They seem extremely muscular. It's so powerful to watch them move.
They are solid muscle and loose skin. So that if they're kicked or an antler hits them, their skin sort of shifts, which, you know, is a defense. So they have this loose skin, which, you know, covers this amazingly muscular body that people don't even realize is beneath it sometimes until they see them in a crouch or something where their muscles bulge. But yeah, absolutely super strong, can leap, you know, tremendous distances. You hear all sorts of things in the literature, or you can read them, like different distances. I myself have seen cats from a standstill jump 20 feet.
Wow.
And, you know, in a lateral. And then vertically, we've seen them jump, 15 feet up a cliff face. So it's, I mean, impressive athletes that, you know, really beyond anything we can imagine. You know, there are many days when we're following cats where we're like, well, we can't do that. We're going to have to turn around. And because you can't compete.
Sure. And what role do they play in an ecosystem? Why are they so ecologically important?
That's another great question. They have influence on their ecosystems in numerous ways. And we have found they are more important than we realized. And they do all sorts of crazy things. Like many folks think of bears bringing in marine nutrients into landscapes by killing salmon and things like that. And that's a really important thing. Marine nutrients are dense, they're rich, they can really enrich an ecosystem that's coastal, a terrestrial landscape. And we found out that cats are doing it too by killing seals and sea lions or dragging up their carcasses up into the woods, and salmon even as well. They fish for salmon.
Oh, wow.
So that's just one small thing that they do. I think a lot of their sort of major influences would be either through food provisioning, because so much of what they bring down as prey is shared by the community. And the more kinds of animals that are sharing food in a food network, the stronger or the more resilient the ecosystem, because now you have energy moving along many, many paths. And so just by creating carrion, which is dead meat, on a landscape, and large carrion especially, you get things like chickadees and squirrels and mice and shrews and weasels and ringtails and vultures and eagles and bears and foxes and coyotes and on, like literally large proportions of the community that are present will take part in this free food. And the energy moves across this like network, if you will. And by building those networks of food exchange and energy transfer, it fortifies an ecosystem. Because when it's wounded, whether it's a wildfire, a disease outbreak, a timber company comes through and harvests, that forest ecosystem or that ecosystem needs to heal. And to do that, you move energy across pathways. And the more pathways you have, the faster and more complete the healing can be, if you think of it that way. And so that's one of their big things. And then the other is that they do influence how other species live on the landscape. So they quite literally move deer and elk and other prey who are sort of, to use a loose word, afraid of cats. So they move on the landscape in a different way. And so the deer are now pooping in certain places that they wouldn't have been in the absence of a cat. They are now eating in places where they wouldn't have been eating if the cats weren't there. And so it redistributes nutrients in all these strange ways because the defecations of large ungulate herds are amazing nutrient resources for landscapes. So that part they are influencing where that's happening and how often it's happening, but also where the deer and elk and all these others are foraging really influences forest structure as well. And so that again is another powerful influence that's sort of invisible they're having on the landscape. They influence coyotes and bobcats and foxes, and they help a lot of the smaller carnivores survive harsh winters where it's super temperate because they, you know, it's a lean time of year. So all of them start disproportionately spending time following mountain lions and other large carnivores to feed from their prey. Lots and lots of cool roles that they play supporting us and healthy ecosystems upon which we all depend.
Right. And you mentioned that they are solo creatures, or very individual. What does the mating then look like?
Oh, yeah. So courtship is fascinating. You know, it's finally being documented really in the wild in the last 10 years plus. But, you know, previously it was always sort of in zoos. But males typically have these massive ranges, sort of at least 250 square miles, and sometimes twice that. And they overlap with three, four females. And this is sort of a typical scenario I'm describing. And they keep tabs on them. They're like constantly checking in on each other. And the second a female comes into heat, which in some ways is sort of a product of spending time with males because they require the actual physical touch for the egg to drop and to go into estrus. And so there's sort of this exchange. The males are constantly in touch with them. And then a female comes into heat and she'll caterwaul, just like, you know, you may have heard the yowl of a house cat when they're in heat. And females do the same thing. It carries a long distance and it pulls in any male. And so they'll come in and he'll find her. And then they'll spend, you know, typically 3, 4 days together traveling, mating frequently, like very frequent short mating sessions. And then the male goes off, and 3 months later, she has kittens. And those kittens are born generally in like some sort of fortress that she does not create, but finds. So, like a think of like a couple of trees fall over, and they create like a network, a dense network of branches, and like a little fortress she can dig into. Sometimes they'll go into rock ledges and things like that, but that's sort of more movie mountain lion dens than real life dens. They're usually in thickets and really dense vegetation. And yeah, then she raises those kittens, and you know, she'll be keeping them kind of hidden and safe for at least 2 months, and then they'll start tripping along behind her, and she'll leave them at different places while she hunts, and usually at a, you know, near a kill. And they just spend, you know, sort of roughly 18 months with her, sometimes as long as 21, 22 months.
Oh, wow.
other side, learning from her, spending all their time just with her.
And these creatures, they're so beautiful, they're so stealth, there's so much they do for our ecosystem, and yet they're also feared. And you tackle those themes in an upcoming film that's called Heart of a Lion. And it's an interesting title because the meaning of Heart of a Lion, when you look that up, it's exceptional. It's courage and bravery. And these animals are so resilient. And you even allude to their emotional intelligence. So tell me about this film and why it was important for you to make it and for people to understand more about mountain lions.
Yes, thanks for that. So I wrote a book tackling these very questions called The Cougar Conundrum, and Joe Pontecorvo read that book and said, "Gosh, could we do some sort of movie spin-off that addresses some of these questions?" And so that was where it all started. Joe approached me and said, "Would you like to do this film? And just would love to kind of cover some of these challenging aspects of living with cats and sort of some of the controversy around them." He was particularly taken with the sort of secret social lives of cats. And so that was sort of how we launched. And I would say that, the film, so is it a fascinating process to kind of participate in, because I'm not a filmmaker and this is Joe's world. And Joe had a couple of ideas. He said he wanted first the film to be slow, like meaning he wanted the rhythm to be slow. He says so many like television's sort of versions of movies, which are 44 minutes or 46 with commercials to make it the full hour. You're just like jumping from thing to thing to thing because you don't have the time to let the audience slow down and to flow. And so he wanted it to be slow. But because it had to be slow, or he wanted it to be slow, it meant we could include less topics. And I think one of the big emphasis of the movie is this family dynamic of mountain lions that people have ignored or been unaware of for so long, and how they really are a family-centric species. Females spend, 82, 84% of their lives in the company of kittens. And everything they do is sort of an investment in that next generation as they grow and hunt, et cetera. And then they learn the sort of social skills of interacting or how to interact with other adult lions. And then they can share food and interact with each other on the landscape in ways that facilitate the community rather than undermine it. And, I think that was sort of one of his, he really wanted to the audience to walk away thinking about the secret social lives of mountain lions, and that they are, in many ways like us, in that they have families, and that families are what contribute to a community, and that they're all individuals, that they're not all the same. They hunt different things, they mother in different ways, that they really are individual animals doing their best to survive in a sometimes hostile world.
I'm really excited about this film. It's called Heart of a Lion, and it's actually going to be showing here in our community on April 23rd. And it's part of the Park City Film Real Community Series, which means that it's at no cost. So people can come and see this film, learn more about mountain lions, and then afterward, there's going to be a post-film discussion with you so people can come prepared with questions. Why do you want to spread the word about mountain lions now that you have been working with them for so long? Why is it important to you to let people understand this species better?
That's a it's a big question. I mean, it's bigger than it sounds, I think. Because it's I think you just touched on part of it, is that, to help people understand the positive roles they play. So I'd say the film has sort of three big themes. There's the social lives, that they're family-centric. The second is that we talk about the ecosystem roles that they play. And then the third is about living with them in our backyards and the conflict that sometimes ensues. And I guess, for me, what I'd love, I mean, at this stage is, it's after doing this for a long time, kind of working on their conservation, trying to learn about them, and realizing that this species really is resilient, meaning that they can bounce back, that we have persecuted them harshly. We tried to eradicate them when the Europeans first started moving west and did so successfully in much of the east. And they are still here. And that story in its of itself is amazing. And they are rebounding. Certainly in the West, they have rebounded. And now it really is up to us to decide whether we want to live alongside them. It's not up to them. And so over the course of my work, it's funny, ironically, I began in this world thinking I would be able to live alone in the wild with animals. But I spend more and more time talking to people about animals now because that's the final frontier. We need to help people understand that it's up to us, that it's in our hands. Like, we make the decision whether the mountain lions will persist, whether they'll be allowed to live peacefully alongside us or not. And to help, as you said, we need to learn as much about them, to celebrate them, and that this film is very much in tune with this idea that we want people to come in and leave the theater with a new appreciation for the species. It's like a reintroduction. You can show up with an assumption of what a mountain lion is, and we hope you leave with a different assumption, one that allows you to start considering that, gosh, I wouldn't mind to have mountain lions as neighbors, and that I would support them living alongside me, because that would be the change we need to see their conservation improve throughout the West.
Well, Dr. Elbrock, we appreciate you. We appreciate what you are doing in the world of wildcat science and conservation. And the film, again, is called Heart of a Lion. It will be playing as part of the Real Community Series at Park City Film, which is at the Jim Santee Auditorium on April 23rd. It starts at 7 p.m. So thank you so much. It's Dr. Mark Elbrook, who is an ecologist, author, scientist, and storyteller, and now part of the filmmaking world. Thank you so much for talking with
Thank
us
you.
today on This Green Earth.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you have an idea, we'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas and topics, your storylines. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. You can also find us wherever you listen to your podcast. If you like the show and you learn something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.